From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. From sorting to taxonomy, one scientist thought he was ordering the world. But really, he was fostering more division.
There were eugenics fairs at small town festivals where there'd be competitions and there'd be the best babies or the fittest families.
It was so gross.
It was so gross.
You know what they say about the path to hell. Also, how librarians are grappling with the legacy systems they use to organize the books on their shelves.
Books on Obama were in 300s. They were separated from books on other presidents. And that was very disturbing to me. And that was the beginning of changing Dewey, of rebelling against Dewey.
The powers and perils of classification after this.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Humans, as a species, have a fascination with order. We like categories, lists, and rankings, and labeling them all. In fact, much of science is devoted to sorting the seeming chaos of the natural world. Of course, sometimes we go too far or in the wrong direction by imposing an artificial order based on irrelevant criteria or bias. Last year, I spoke with Radiolab co-host Lulu Miller, who was struggling to impose order on her own life when she became obsessed with the 19th and 20th century taxonomist and natural historian David Starr Jordan. Jordan himself was obsessed with cataloging and ordering the world. 100 years later, that passion earned him a starring role in Miller's book, Why Fish Don't Exist, a story of loss, love, and the hidden order of life.
There are things that he does, especially when he's a kid, that just make you fall in love with him. When he gets bullied, he starts doing things alone, like trying to complete the task of clasping his hands and jump through them. So, like, he's just this sweet loner.
His Puritan parents, especially his mother, disapproved of his obsessions and his massive collections.
Yeah, he sort of woke into the world. He had all these questions about what he saw around him. And so first he started putting names to every star in the sky. He moved on to flowers and he started pinning them to the walls and writing their scientific names underneath them, making topographical maps of every place around him. And at one point, his mom just threw them away.
His entire childhood was bound up in this stuff.
So much sweaty, sweet, careful labor. And she just thought, this is a waste of time. He should be out on the farm. They were struggling to make, you know, ends meet. And she told him to, quote, find something more relevant to do with his time. According to his accounts, taxonomy had sort of had its run. Carl Linnaeus, the famous forefather of taxonomy, had published his Systema Naturae, which was proposed to be this map of all life properly arranged about 100 years before. There was this sense that the world was known. We didn't need to look at it anymore. His neighbors called him shiftless and a waster of time. Collecting got sort of a bad rap. And as he grew older, he just still loved doing it. His brother died when he was pretty young, and he had been very close with him. And right after that moment, he just goes back to drawing, and his journals explode with color. He's drawing ivy, he's drawing carrots, he's drawing pine branches, like anything he can get his hands on.
Your theory is that he was trying to impose order on chaos.
Yeah, he talks about this urge. Even if he can't control the world, at least he had naming. If he could just order the world, there was some sense of agency. I don't want to go overly into like pathologizing the very human impulse to collect and know our world. But there are some people who've studied obsessive collectors. Often the habit will kick into gear after some sort of major deprivation or tragedy or trauma. Each acquisition floods you with this sense of fantasized omnipotence, is how this one guy, Werner Mustenberger, puts it, that you can kind of become addicted to.
In his early 20s, he is a perpetual student. He's also an educator. He learns about a sort of camp for young natural historians, an island off of Massachusetts called Penikese.
Yeah, it's this tiny little horseshoe-shaped island, an hour's ride away from the coast, just horizon on every side of you. Louis Agassiz, the very famous Swiss geologist, who by this point was teaching at Harvard, decided that the way that Harvard professors were teaching science was all wrong. They wanted their students to learn to memorize beliefs out of books. And he thought that beliefs were roadblocks, because once you started to believe the beliefs,
you ceased to observe.
Yeah, you would cease to observe. And so he started this camp where he could train the future scientists of America in the right way to do science, which is climbing around in nature, getting dirty, looking at things through microscopes. And that first summer, he put out a call for applications. David Starr Jordan was miserable out at this college in the Midwest. He was advised not to let his students touch microscopes. He was chastised for teaching the Ice Age theory, that there had been a time when the Earth was covered in ice, and Louis Agassiz was the guy who discovered it, blah, blah, blah. So he applies to this camp, gets in. He's one of 50 students, men and women, all interested in taxonomy. Spends this blissed out summer. He sees phosphorescence for the first time. He's 22 years old, and it's the first time he sees the ocean.
And the impact of Louis Agassiz can't be underrated. You wrote about a breakfast benediction that he gave. It went like this. Said the master to the youth, "We have come in search of truth, trying with uncertain key, door by door of mystery. We are reaching through his laws to the garment hem of cause. Him, the endless, unbegun, the unnameable, the one. As with fingers of the blind, we are groping here to find what the hieroglyphics mean of the unseen in the seen."
Agassiz literally thought that every single species was a thought of God, and that the work of taxonomy was to arrange those thoughts in their proper order and discover the divine plan of God. And what the divine plan meant was this intricate communication of God's values and how to be in the world, and possibly, if you read it right, the path to further ascension. And so Agassiz called the work of taxonomy missionary work of the highest order. David writes about that morning. He said it was this transformational moment in his life, because suddenly he had a response to all the people who said that his hobby was pointless.
He traveled the globe to, quote, discover new species of fish, catalog them, name them.
Yeah. He starts collecting for the Smithsonian. He gets promotions. He becomes the president of Indiana University. He'd throw dynamite into the water to unearth fish. He would use harpoons, like any method he could think of, and poison. He would, in tide pools, he came up with this device.
Strychnine, which plays a role later in his story, but we might not get to that. The possibility that he murdered the head of Stanford, but never mind. You became enamored with the idea of David Starr Jordan as a symbol of determination in the face of chaos. He lost his collection multiple times over the course of his life, especially during the San Francisco earthquake of 1906. It was stored at Stanford. A whole system of order obliterated, and he and his team are credited with discovering a fifth of the fish species that were then known.
Yeah. His first collection was struck by lightning and burnt to the ground. I mean, it almost feels like a myth. He thinks he can order the world. Chaos says, can you? He builds it back up. It takes almost 30 years. And an earthquake comes, and he loses thousands of fish. They're separated from their names. And it was this moment where he did this gesture, and this gesture is what pulled me into his tale. I didn't even know who he was yet, but I heard this anecdote, and I know it is almost embarrassingly arcane. Why did this possess your life for 10 years? Why did you write a book about this guy? But this was the moment. He took the fish off the ground, and he started the practice of tying the label to the fish, stitching them right into the flesh, as if to say, nature, no matter what you throw at me, I can own you. And I thought, this is such a metaphor for our species and for our need to know the world and possess it, the refusal to back down from these increasingly clear messages that chaos reigns, that we live in a world that we cannot control.
When you learned darker and darker things about how he conducted his life, he had a shield of optimism, which sounds like something great, but when you break it down, he was really good about lying to himself.
Yes. A colleague of his said, no matter how bad the day, he could always be found a humming a tune adown the arcade. But what is that shield comprised of? And one of the key ingredients is to believe you're a little better than you actually are. Psychologists have studied this. They call it positive illusions. And it's this idea that if we can lie to ourselves a little bit, you actually see profound benefits in mental health, even in relationships. It's kind of like a matter of how much delusion, and there is clearly a slippery slope where, you know, you do get social punishment for being too deluded about yourself or your abilities. But there is this weird spot. If you lie a little, it serves you really well.
Right. But he was making judgments that he wasn't capable of making. And like his mentor, Louis Agassiz, he ranked what he found. And like his mentor, he believed bad habits, so to speak, could cause species to devolve, whether in mollusks or in man.
Yes. When Darwin came along, David Starr Jordan did do away with the idea that there was a divine plan. He did let go of God, but he still believed there was a somewhat divine hierarchy carved by time, that more quote-unquote complex, if such a thing is even measurable, meant more evolved, meant better as well.
Darwin never did that. He never ranked species from complex and closer to God to degenerate, intrinsically evil.
Yeah, I mean, Darwin has his sins and he's complicated. But what really shocked me reading On the Origin of Species and rereading it and reading it with a pen was just how clearly he warns against ranking. And he says that hierarchies and even categories at all, even edges in nature, and this is what really blew my mind, that those are fabrication of the human mind. They're superimposition. They're a proxy.
Edges. What do you mean by edges?
That there are not hard lines even between species. One of the things he really hammers, this gets a little technical, but it's cool. One of the things that taxonomists say is that two different species can't create fertile offspring. And he just shows time and time again these examples where actually two different supposed species do create fertile offspring. There aren't the hard lines around species or around genera or going further up the tree, phylum even, that is a human way of parsing the world to feel safer in it.
Darwin's disinclination to put species in boxes and especially to rank them did not communicate to Starr. And a turning point for him was when he went to Aosta, a sanctuary city in Italy, a place where for centuries the Catholic Church had provided shelter and food to people who had been rejected by their families because of their disabilities.
You might see beauty in that town. Here's a place where people have safe harbor and are given the tools to flourish. Or what David saw, and he went three times, he called it, quote, a veritable chamber of horrors. People drooling or coming up to him and begging. And he said, you know, this is a subspecies of man, and this is where the whole human race is going if we don't take action. And he becomes one of the earliest embracers of eugenics.
He thought that the people of Aosta were literally degenerating into a new species of man, and he called this process animal pauperism.
Yes, that laziness, quote unquote, basically the bad habits, the bad behaviors, can cause not just a person, but a species to sort of reverse evolve, to slide down that ladder.
He didn't believe in nurture much at all. It was all about nature for him.
He actively, in some of his books, he mocks education. He says education can never replace heredity. And he begins to believe that all kinds of traits are linked to the blood. Criminality, poverty, illiteracy, what they call feeble-mindedness, that we could reduce all kinds of things by not allowing certain people to continue to live.
Coming up, the conclusion of our interview with Lulu Miller.
I was spat out near the top of this social hierarchy. I'm queer, so knock me down a little, but I'm a white woman. I'm near the top, and our world is so disorienting, and sure, that can feel frightening. For me, I just keep thinking about the concept of order as this violent structure, and things have to change.
This is On the Media.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Continuing our 2020 conversation with Radiolab co-host Lulu Miller, we turn to the dark side of taxonomist David Starr Jordan's fervent effort to bring order to the natural world over a century ago, a fervor that led him to the practice of eugenics, which advocated the deeply disquieting practice of improving our species by encouraging reproduction in some and suppressing it in others.
The simplest thought was that you could actually kill people. He didn't think that was humane, so he suggested the idea of sterilization. Single out people he called quote-unquote unfit. Again, you see him employing scientific jargon to make his beliefs sound like a biological reality, but he starts advocating for these ideas as a great way to heal society into his lectures at Stanford. He talks to this really wealthy widow, Mrs. Harriman, and gets her to donate hundreds of thousands of dollars to start the Eugenics Record Office, which will become a huge player in claiming certain people are unfit based on their criminal records or their hospital records, things like that. He joins political organizations. He's a huge pusher for these ideas. And starting in 1907, the first eugenics law is passed in his one-time stomping ground of Indiana. And it's the very first time in the world that there is forced eugenic sterilization for someone deemed unfit. He helped get it passed in California. And slowly, in the early 1900s, more and more states are passing these mandatory eugenic sterilization laws.
This law isn't just the first in the country, it's the first in the world.
There is resistance. Judges or governors who strike down their state's attempted eugenics law. And there are activists and even scientists calling the ideas behind eugenics, quote unquote, rot. But it did sweep the country. There were these eugenics fairs at small town festivals where they would have a tent where there'd be competitions among the babies who were sort of weighed and measured like pumpkins, and there'd be the best babies or the fittest families.
It was so gross.
It was so gross.
Just deciding what is a desirable characteristic is such a horrible slippery slope, as you mentioned. You spend some time with the Virginia State Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded in Lynchburg, Virginia. In the 20s, under Chief Albert Priddy, the center started sterilizing women to cleanse the nation of the subpar, starting with Carrie Buck. At the age of 17, She got raped. She gave birth. Then her parents dropped her off on Dr. Pretty's doorstep, and he noticed that she looked familiar to another one of his inmates.
She was the daughter of Emma Buck, who was in the colony under allegations of prostitution and perhaps drug use. Pretty was a passionate eugenicist. He'd sterilized all kinds of people before Carrie, mostly women, for having wanderlust, for passing notes in class. He had been searching for a case that could help him prove what he was doing was, you know, biologically sound. And he realized, okay, well, if she's here, maybe this is proof that quote-unquote feeble-mindedness is heritable, because here we have a woman forced by circumstances to become a prostitute, and here, look, her daughter was raped, and therefore I'm judging her promiscuous. All we need to do is test her baby. And then if there's proof of feeble-mindedness there, we'll have proof that really feeble-mindedness is heritable over the generations. And so he had someone from the Eugenics Record Office come out and test this little baby, just a few months old. And, you know, they maybe ran a penny in front of her eyes. It's not clear exactly what tests were run, but that researcher declared the baby feeble-minded, a little baby, based on these bunk tests. And this case, the sterilization of Carrie Buck, eventually made it all the way to the Supreme Court in 1927 under this question of, can we sterilize a person for the good of the rest of society under this eugenic ideology? And long story short, they voted 8-1 in favor of sterilizing her under the idea that three generations of imbeciles is enough.
I was just wondering if this is a good time to mention Hitler.
Yes. The American movement predated Hitler's movement. Some of the early posters to pass sterilization in Germany said, "We do not stand alone." And there was a picture of the American flag. Americans had sterilized thousands of people. And then in 1933, Germany passed the law to allow the sterilization of what would eventually become hundreds of thousands of people. And an American eugenicist, Joseph DeJarnett, said, "The Germans are beating us at our own game." You know, I think these ideas arise from different places. Francis Galton coined the term eugenics in England. And of course, like this idea of bettering a herd on your farm, like that has been around for a long time. So these ideas are coming up from all over, but we were the first to legalize it in the world and to make real headway on these ideas that certain people in society should not be allowed to live, and that that will be better for the rest of us, and that there is some kind of ideal to empower and support, and we should get rid of the rest actively. And a lot of these people, Agassiz, David Starr Jordan, DeJarnett, they're all over buildings. They have statues of them up at academic institutions. And these were people really actively pushing for the genetic death of certain kinds of people.
And so Jordan becomes a cautionary tale about where the drive to impose order on the world can take us. One of the big reveals in your book comes in the title, Fish Don't Exist. Tell me what you meant by that.
So this is this amazing revelation in the biological community that taxonomists realized in about the 80s. And it goes back to the Darwin thing, that actually the edges in nature are not there. This group of scientists called cladists came along and—
Before you get into it, why are they called cladists?
So cladus is Greek for branch, and it is the branches of the tree of life that they are interested in looking at accurately, not based on this human-centric sense of what goes together. You could lump together anything that has stripes, then there'd be zebrafish and zebra and those little furry caterpillars, but that is not a scientifically meaningful category of creatures if you're trying to group things in terms of how they're related. So this is the whole puzzle of taxonomy. How do you decide who is closest to whom? And so around the 80s, the cladists kind of stumbled across this idea that certain characteristics give you better clues. So they'd say, you know, look, we got to not be distracted by things like skin or fur. We have to look deeper at the bone structure and the organs. So they would say, I'm going to hold up an image of a cow, a salmon, and a lungfish. Lungfish looks like a pretty fishy fish, scaly tail. Which of these two things are most closely related? And inevitably, a biology student would raise their hand and say, the salmon and the lungfish. You know, they're both fish. They swim in water. That's my guess. And then slowly, the clatis would reveal why this isn't true. And they'd say, well, look, both the lungfish and the cow have lungs. They both have this thing called an epiglottis, which is this little flap of skin that goes over the throat that kind of came along later in time. And they have a more similarly structured heart. You can't deny that actually a cow and a lungfish are more closely related to one another than a lungfish and a salmon. And what that means is that, okay, you know, if you want to keep fish together, you'd have to include a cow in there and a human and a bird. You could keep all fish together, but then it's more like the word vertebrate. Like, it's so broad that actually the more scientifically sound thing to do is admit that fish is not a legitimate grouping of creatures that aren't actually close. And you can see it's very naturally carved out by the water. You know, we just think they have these tails and they have these fins, and so they're all fish. But that is obscuring a greater truth, that there are things down there that are more closely related to us than to one another. I learned this concept as I was researching Jordan, and it completely blew my mind. And it was this like violently counterintuitive thought. I have a sense that it matters, that this isn't just a nerdy linguistic party trick. Fish don't exist. Yeah, they do. Then I set out to try to understand that. I titled the book that. I know people get annoyed. They roll their eyes. Fish don't exist. But my sincere hope is that you emerge from this story not only understanding and hopefully believing that idea, but carrying it around with you as a reminder to have more doubt in all categories around you.
One dismaying conclusion you came to, dismaying and wonderful, is that if you're a cladist, you are far less inclined to other creatures, if I'm using other as a verb there. And especially you talk about fish, some of whom have memory, senses of humor. Pescatarians are out of luck.
Yeah. I think it's about having a real vibrant curiosity about anything, you know, about any category you're making, whether it's in fish or whether it's in a type of student that you're not accepting to your institution. These eugenic sterilization laws that just kind of soberly allowed for the violent cutting off of your chance to carry on. You know, just because we say this word unfit that we think we have a grasp on, and there are still laws on the books that now use slightly different terms, like incompetent or unable to give informed consent or lacks mental capacity, that allow for the mandatory sterilization of people. And are we so sure we're okay about that? Who is hiding under that language? Why fish don't exist is this absurd French surrealist painting, this is not a pipe kind of thing. But my hope is that what that does is to remind you that, like, we are bad at carving up our world. The work of being a good human is to keep real vigilant curiosity about the creatures trapped underneath our categories.
And even harder, it seems, to accomplish is to let go of your intuition.
Yeah.
And you wrote that seeing the world, or trying to, without intuition, I mean, we can't obviously let it all go, was a peculiarly marvelous feeling.
Yeah, and it's hard. Like, what do we have in the dark but our intuition to guide us? I suck at it most days, most moments.
Can you find that place in the end of the book or one of them where you write about going into nature and being really conscious
of what I don't know?
Not doing what we're all wired to do.
Yeah. Let me find one. How about this? So this is in the epilogue. When I give up the fish, I get a skeleton key. A fish-shaped skeleton key that pops the grid of rules off this world and lets you step through to a wilder place. The other world within this one. the gridless place out the window where fish don't exist and diamonds rain from the sky and each and every dandelion is reverberating with possibility. To turn that key, all you have to do is stay wary of words. If fish don't exist, what else do we have wrong?
Despite the fact that science stands with the cladists with regard to the existence of fish, nobody wants to go there.
Yeah.
It is just not catching on. Obviously, intuition is just implacably strong.
Mm-hmm.
But could you tell me some of the marvels you encountered when you were able to let it go? I mean, you describe in the book a lifelong existential ailment.
Yeah.
And suppressing that intuition seemed to be a means of dealing with it.
Yeah, I do think with intuition comes a certainty of you know what's good for you, you know what you're bad at, you know what's scary, all these things. And when you can just suppress it a little and say, maybe, but let's go investigate, I have continued to be wowed by surprises and things that existed outside of my intuition or my certainty. One of the biggest marvels was meeting my now wife and still thinking she's younger than me, she's shorter than me, she's a girl. That's not what keeps me safe. That's not what is a mate. You know, these kind of silly criteria took a second to let go of. I mean, it was mostly guided by how freaking delightful she is to be around and how fun she makes the world. But I think there was a little bit of all this research in there because I met her toward the end of writing this. And I think she was this huge, clear gift of what you can welcome in when you do that. That's an obvious one. But then even just little things.
The past several months have offered lots of chances to let go of preconceived notions of what's what.
Yeah.
You started to see order itself as a kind of violence.
Yeah. The word itself, order, or denim, comes from the Latin for loom, which is arranging of threads neatly in a loom. And then it became to be used metaphorically as the way that people sit under the ranks of a king or an army general. Order itself, you know, it is based on the discounting of certain qualities within people to make them fit in this unnatural form on the loom. I think that with all the rebellion and the unrest, it's like people who have been trapped for so long under this violent order and no one has been listening. Look, I was spat out near the top of this social hierarchy. I'm queer, so knock me down a little, but I'm a white woman. I'm near the top. And our world is so disorienting, and sure, that can feel frightening. But it is this moment. For me, I just keep thinking about the concept of order as this violent structure, and things have to change.
What is the most revelatory, order-overthrowing thing that you learned about a fish?
They've done these studies that show that they will actively seek out the soothing of either the touch of another fish or sometimes even the touch of a human hand that they've grown comfortable with. And that, like us, when they are afraid, when they are in some kind of physical pain, there is this strange power in being held. And that, like, it's not some whiz-bangy, they can memorize 10,000 places, which they can also do. They have incredible cognitive skills. But there was something so, there's more similarity down there. There's more difference too, but just that there's more nuance. There are more unexpected qualities down there. So that, yeah, that's the one. For some reason, that being with another being helps them.
Wow. Lulu, thank you so much.
Yeah.
We spoke with Lulu last year just before the election, when chaos did indeed loom large. She's the co-host of Radiolab and author of Why Fish Don't Exist, a story of loss, love, and the hidden order of life. Coming up, lessons from a place where classification is a big deal, the world of libraries.
Well, can you believe that the Library of Congress would make a decision with a bunch of liberal students from Dartmouth University who sent a petition to them to say that this was a dehumanizing or an inflammatory term, and to make that decision on political correctness to change something that has been in the lexicon there at our Library of Congress since back in the early 1900s is just unbelievable to me.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Lulu Miller explains the perils and limitations of imposing order on the world. Order, codes, and standards can make the world seem to function more comprehensively and efficiently. Like the standards for the electric current that runs through the walls, or the internet standards that let us send messages back and forth, or the credit card standards that allow us to pay with a swipe of plastic. All these can make navigating the world seem a whole lot easier, but they're also centers of power. On the Media producer Molly Schwartz brings us the story of how power has become entrenched quietly through standards in a quiet place, the library.
So I've been there 12 years.
Jess DeCourcy-Hines is a writer and the director of the Bard High School Early College Queens Library.
I founded it. I started it from the ground up.
As the solo librarian, she has to do everything herself, including catalog all the books, using the Dewey Decimal System.
We librarians who work with Dewey are well-versed in these numbers.
For all the non-librarians out there, a quick primer on the Dewey Decimal System.
Have you ever watched the way others use the library? There's quite a difference in the way they go about it.
It's organized into 10 main classes of knowledge, with each class represented by numbers. Philosophy and psychology are the 100s, the 200s are religion, social sciences are in the 300s, the 400s are language, and the 500s are science. Catalogers can add more numbers to make a Dewey's number more specific to the book it's describing.
Each figure in the number is significant. 510 tells us the books deal with mathematics. 520 tells us the books deal with astronomy. 530 is physics.
And rounding out the 10 main classes are technology, arts and recreation, literature, history, and computer science and other information. It's a hierarchical structure in which all of these classes have nearly endless permutations.
You'll be looking for many books in the 800s. You know what they are? Literature? That's right. 810s are American literature. 820s are English literature. 830s are German.
One day in 2010, the Bard High School Early College Library received a large order of books about the Civil Rights Movement, which Jess DeCourcy-Hines was excited about because
our history section was feeling very white.
But when this big order of civil rights books came in, she noticed they weren't classified under history in the 900s, but under the 300s.
The 300s are a grab bag of books.
They include everything from anthropology and sociology, labor studies, political science, and folklore, but also some books that could possibly be classified in the 900s, the history section.
Books on Obama were in 300s. They were separated from books on other presidents. And that was very disturbing to me. And I just didn't understand why our current president was not going to be part of history.
And Obama wasn't the only one stuffed in the 300s.
And then when it came to the LGBTQ books and the women's history books and books on immigrant history, all of those were in the 300s as well. And I realized that women, immigrants, and people of color were all being pigeonholed in this very strange 300 section. So we just started moving them.
She and her student interns decided to put President Obama where they thought he belonged, in the 900s, next to the other presidents.
And that was the beginning of changing Dewey, of rebelling against Dewey.
DeCourcy-Hines wrote about her frustrations with Dewey in a New York Times essay called "Oh Dewey, Where Would You Put Me?" There have been critiques of Melville Dewey and his system dating back to the early 1900s, and recently, some libraries have been ditching Dewey in favor of bookstore-style organization.
Public libraries are rolling out a new system where books are now organized by categories such as animals or computers.
People don't come in and go, "I feel like an 8-11 today." No, they think, "I want poetry."
The Greenwood Public Library is ditching Dewey for a shelf system they call Subject Savvy.
For most of the Dewey Decimal System's 145 years in use, Melville Dewey has been celebrated as a kind of founding father of American librarianship.
We're always searching for heroes, and Dewey was a early library pioneer whose influence was very wide.
Wayne Wiegand is a library historian and the author of Irrepressible Reformer, a biography of Melville Dewey. He describes how Melville Dewey created the Dewey Decimal System in the early 1870s when he was a student at Amherst College.
The Amherst College campus between 1870 and 1874 was a very white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant, male-dominated world. Dewey pretty much programmed into his system the priorities, of course, which brought also the biases and the prejudices of that world into his classification scheme. You can tell this very easily in the 200s and the religions, which heavily privileges Protestantism against all other kinds of religion.
In fact, 9/10 of the 200s are dedicated to Christianity. Like David Starr Jordan, who Lulu Miller wrote about in her book, Melville Dewey was a late 19th century eccentric who loved to classify things. In fact, the lives of Melville Dewey and David Starr Jordan have some other eerie parallels. They were both born into strict Protestant households in upstate New York in 1851, and they both died in 1931. And Dewey also had views that made him, if not an outright eugenicist, at least eugenics adjacent.
He was certainly sympathetic with the ideas that the eugenicists put forth. He did not see black people as equal to white people. He did not see Jewish people as equal to white people.
Books by black authors were classified in Dewey under slavery or colonization. Even a book of poems by James Weldon Johnson, a famous black writer. When LGBTQ topics get Dewey numbers in the 1930s, they're categorized as abnormal psychology, perversion, derangement, and medical disorders.
That system will reflect the ideology of the people who designed it.
Emily Drabinski is the interim chief librarian of the Mina Reiss Library at CUNY.
You can add new language and revise old language, but essentially you are always putting a new item into a pre-existing system.
The Dewey Decimal System is like the original YouTube algorithm. Its power comes from the fact that it groups books next to other books on related subjects, so that when you're browsing the shelves, you're basically recommended other books you might like. Dewey wasn't the first person to think of this idea, but he was a brilliant businessman who found himself in the right place at the right time.
Andrew Carnegie was donating millions of dollars to put up thousands of public libraries across the country, and it was in a rare community that did not have a public library by 1920.
And Dewey was poised to supply them with an organizational system and an army of librarians to implement it.
And his scheme was there, and it was being promoted by his students and the library press and the library organizations.
For Dewey, his classification was always meant to organize all the knowledge in the world. But of course, times change. New technology gets invented, cultural norms evolve, geopolitics shift, so the Dewey Decimal System is regularly revised. For a long time, those revisions happened within a kind of black box. But according to Caroline Sacucci, who works at the Library of Congress, where she spent 9 years as the Dewey Program Manager, it's become more democratic over time.
A lot of work has been done to really promote this community engagement aspect for the Dewey classification, which I think can only make it better and make it stronger and have community members take ownership of it as well.
Since 2019, proposed Dewey revisions are posted online and open to public comment. Librarians can even contribute Dewey numbers back into the system. And of course, an especially frustrated librarian can always just go rogue.
There's no library police that are going to come out and tell the library they've done it wrong. Libraries are always free to arrange materials according to the way they want them and that will best serve their users.
But that's easier said than done.
Anytime there's a major change to a classification system, it could wreak havoc with the collection because that means that all the bibliographic records have to be changed, but then all the physical items have to be relabeled and then reshelved. And then signage has to change. And I mean, there's just a whole lot that has to happen in order to reclassify large swaths of material.
Aside from Dewey, there are other library classification systems, including the Library of Congress classification system. It's one of the other largest systems in the world, and it's the brainchild of another white man that's beset with some of the same problems as Dewey.
The Library of Congress classification system comes from Thomas Jefferson's collection of materials. The Library of Congress, the initial collection for Congress, burns down. Jefferson makes a donation to the state of his personal collection, and the classification reflects his original order for his own materials.
Instead of using numbers to classify books, the Library of Congress system uses subject headings. And in 2014, a student at Dartmouth College named Melissa Padilla was doing a research project on undocumented youth organizing. She went to meet with Jill Barron, a Dartmouth librarian, to find resources. And they noticed a subject heading that Melissa found disturbing.
There were pages and pages of variations on the term illegal aliens. This was the term that had been used to categorize this particular book.
That's Jill Barron in the documentary Change the Subject. A group of Dartmouth students protested the use of the term illegal alien, but they discovered that the problem wasn't with Dartmouth.
We didn't realize that it was like a national database that applied to like every institution. It was, in some ways, our naive understanding of systems.
So the students filed a petition with the Library of Congress to change the subject heading, and the revision was accepted. But this was 2016, a year when the question of immigration was at the center of a contentious presidential race. Republican members of Congress got wind of the proposed change and decided to block it.
Cruz, one of four Republican lawmakers, to sign a letter urging the Library of Congress not to eliminate the term illegal aliens from search terms and cataloging.
Here's Diane Black, a then congressional representative from Tennessee.
Well, can you believe that the Library of Congress would make a decision with a bunch of liberal students from Dartmouth University who sent a petition to them to say that this was a dehumanizing or an inflammatory term? And to make that decision on political correctness to change something that has been in the lexicon there at our Library of Congress since back in the early 1900s is just unbelievable to me.
The change was successfully blocked, and to this day, illegal alien is still an official term in the Library of Congress subject headings. But the incident breathed new life into a movement among librarians who want to reform cataloging, even when that requires working through slow-moving bureaucracies.
It's an intellectual infrastructure.
Emily Drabinski.
Most people don't even know it exists, much less get exercised about it. It's an incredibly difficult ship to maneuver.
In 2013, Drabinski published an article called Queering the Catalog, Queer Theory and the Politics of Correction. She considers herself part of a group of so-called critical catalogers. But libraries, with their committees and careful processes, are a poor match for the speed at which cultures change and evolve.
You have a system that cannot keep up with the rapidly changing language that LGBTQ plus people use to describe themselves, so that you'll have remnants of old language, and that will be the only language that's there. So gay men, lesbian. But there are many, many other words for people in the contemporary moment, and none of them are in the system. The language is never right. It's never correct, because it's always delayed, if language could even be correct in the first place, which I think it probably can't.
She points out that in the Library of Congress classification system, the one her library uses, the problem isn't only how things are named, but that some things aren't named at all.
Another example of how bias is in the system is if I want to look up African-American women's history, I do a search and it comes up. What if I wanted to do research into the history of white women? White is an unmarked category. It doesn't even appear. It's impossible to retrieve. So the normal is not named at all.
For decades, proponents of critical cataloging have been showing the ways that library classification reflects systems of power that are at play outside the library walls and also reinforces them. Some librarians critical of classification systems want to burn them all down and start over, but they're not in the majority.
I always wonder when people say burn it down if they've ever built anything. It can be very, very difficult to build things. The interoperability piece is super important. And if we want libraries to be able to share, we need those systems to continue functioning.
Part of the reason classification is so problematic is because it's inherently reductive. Numbers and language are always flattening the thing they're trying to describe, shrinking big ideas into small codes that can fit on the spine of a book. Talking to library catalogers, I realized this isn't an exact science. It's a craft, one that's at bottom about making sure we have access to the ideas of others.
The most magical thing that libraries do is share. I use OCLC and my records are there, and then I have colleagues on the other side of the planet who are using those same systems as well. And it means that we can go back and forth borrowing and lending between each other. So that interoperability is really important.
In a world without order, our classification systems will always be imperfect approximations. So even if, as Lulu Miller says, fish don't exist, the Dewey Decimal Number for books about fish is 597. And if you go to that spot on the shelf in your local library, you might learn a thing or two about creatures that live underwater. For On the Media, I'm Molly Schwartz.
And that's the show. On the Media is produced by Leah Feder, Michael Loewinger, Eloise Blondio, Rebecca Clark Callender, and Molly Schwartz. Zandra Ellen writes our unique newsletter. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.